Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me today. Sir Kenneth Branagh is no stranger to Shakespeare. Besides his involvement in countless stage productions, including from his own theater company, he's directed and starred in the film adaptations of Henry V, Much Ado About Nothing, Othello, Hamlet, Love's Labor Lost, As You Like It. That is my sophomore college syllabus right there. In his new film, All Is True, Branagh is not performing Shakespeare. He is playing Shakespeare. The film imagines the bard's later years living in Stratford-upon-Avon with his wife and Anne Hathaway, and daughters Susanna and Judith. The Shakespeare in this film is a man coming to terms with his legacy and his life. He is at a crossroads, which often leaves him cross, as in this scene when a young admirer approaches Shakespeare as he gardens, and the conversation goes like this.
Mr. Shakespeare, I don't want to pester you.
Good. Excellent news. Cheerio.
I just wanted to ask you...
The best way to get started as a writer is to start writing.
No, really, could I just...
I don't have a favourite play. I admire all my fellow dramatists equally, and yes, I do think women should be allowed to perform the female roles, as is the practice on the continent now. Please, if you'll excuse me.
I just wanted to ask how you knew.
Knew what?
Everything.
Branagh Shakespeare is struggling to adjust to a retired life while maintaining his sense of worth after years of theatrical success in London. In these final years, he also finds time to mourn the death years earlier of his only son, a process that strains his relationship with the rest of his family, who already resent him for his long absence. Like Shakespeare's own biographical plays, there's a healthy dose of imagination in this story, given how little we know about the man who wrote the plays. Kenneth Branagh stars in the film. He also directed it, by the way. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Allison. Thank you.
When did you first study Shakespeare, just either as a student or as an actor?
Well, I suppose it was around about 13, being taken to a production of Romeo and Juliet with the school, 1,000 kids in a pretty wild reception to this play that was full of fights and, you know, sort of sex and violence. And it got me thinking anyway. And I guess when I was... just about 17, I hitchhiked to Stratford-upon-Avon to go and see the plays in the real place and to go and see the birthplaces where he lived.
Wow.
So I really associate him with my first act of independence, because I was quite a timid lad. And so going off and hitchhiking on your own, pitching a tent and doing all of that was quite something. I discovered working on this film that Ian McKellen, who was in the movie playing the Earl of Southampton, had done the very same thing. We'd pitched tent in the very same campsite with that 25 years between us, and in both cases it had been this pilgrimage to a man whose impact on our professional lives was just starting to have its kind of magnetic grip.
Had you already started to have the feeling that you were going to be an actor or a writer at that point?
For me, from a working class Irish background, it was something that was so far removed. My parents had never heard of really anything to do with the Royal Shakespeare Company up in Stratford, where these plays were being performed, and they were terribly concerned that they were off into a world. My dad was a joiner, a carpenter, if you like. My mum worked in a chip shop, fish and chip shop, and so it was so alien. For me, it was like a great big adventure, and already I think one of the things that really caught my imagination was the sort of disconnect between a man whose influence and whose name was so all pervasive for us, whether it was on tea towels or you know, key rings or whatever, or we were being told he was good for us, and the difficulty sometimes of me or my fellows enjoying it. Sometimes you'd see it or hear it, and it was pretty hard to take. So I wanted to sort of join the dots. What was it that made this thing ultimately, when done well, so powerful? And that meant finding out a bit about the man. So really, that story began when I was 17, and it's segued all the way to this movie, All Is True, trying to find where the man and the genius join up.
Why did knowing about the man, and when did knowing about the man become significant to you?
Well, part of it was what you sort of hinted at in your earlier question. When I looked at this small market town, and when I realized that this man who we barely understood whether he'd even been to school, grammar school is what we suspect, but he left that town at 18. He was in a sort of shotgun marriage with an older woman. She was pregnant, Anne Hathaway, 8 years older than him. He goes off and there are some lost years. But in general, you could describe him as someone from lowly position who, when he reemerges from that sort of those lost years, is suddenly an extremely successful playwright in London, and eventually becomes by the time he starts in this movie, Returning Home, the most prominent writer of the age. So for me, that trip from, you know, the wrong side of the tracks all the way to a position of sort of creative prominence was completely fascinating. And on one level, you thought, well, if Shakespeare can do it, you know, any of us perhaps could be inspired to.
My guest is Sir Kenneth Branagh. The name of the new film is All Is True. That was the title of Henry VIII, the play,
correct,
when it was performed at the Globe. Why do you think it's a good title for this film?
Well, the tease of Shakespeare is that we know maybe 25 things about him from the public record office. You go to Stratford or you go to London, you can find out that, as this film reveals, there was a man who stood up in a church in Stratford in 1614 and accused Shakespeare's elder daughter of adultery and said that she had a sexually transmitted disease. The entire town found out about this. So did Shakespeare. It's all in the public record. He took legal action. And so we know a number of things.
Straight facts.
Straight facts. You know, his son did die when the son was 11, Hamlet, in 1596. The cause of death is unrecorded. Our film speculates about what that cause of death might have been, and indeed what the tragedy of a lost child might have been for any family, but for this family particularly. Shakespeare's titles, like All Is True, or Much Ado About Nothing, or As You Like It, or Twelfth Night, or What You Will, are always a kind of provocation to the audience to sort of try and guess how seriously Shakespeare is suggesting the audience should take this drama. And so it felt like it was the appropriate way to deal with his own life, where this question of whether the loss of a child, which he writes about in his own plays, twins, which he writes about often, and the separation of twins, and then in the later period of his creative life, when he's really writing his very last plays, they're all very problematic family dramas where a almost desperate but certainly very poignant and passionate attempt to make everything work out with a happy ending is provided by magic. He brings magic into his work. He decides to make the last plays fairy tales, almost as if in an act of willful sort of resolution, he will make this life, his life, these lives add up to something beautiful and peaceful, even though the facts of those lives seems to indicate the opposite.
You worked with Ben Elton. Ben Elton, yes. Mm-hmm. And he works on another show about Shakespeare, which is a very cheeky sitcom about Shakespeare's life, how we imagine sort of, I think, all of the family meets Shakespeare. Actually, let's play a little clip of that.
Yeah. Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo? Dad, nobody talks like this.
It's poetry.
I do think it could be a little less flowery, love. I mean, why doesn't she just say, where are you, Romeo?
It doesn't mean, where are you? It means, why are you, Romeo?
That's a bit weird.
I love that. One of the reasons I wanted to play that is it's just so interesting. It's just like a family discussing things, and dad is corny and making dad jokes. And the language in this film is not Shakespearean and lofty. They are having conversations. Mm-hmm. So when you and Ben were talking about how you wanted to show this family, you know, you want to show, not tell, as they say.
Yeah.
What did you want to show about them, about the way they communicated with each other?
Well, partly that some of what that clip suggests operated in our film. So absentee father returns to family. You know, they all have things to say. And like in any family, whatever happens, you know, I'm sure that you go home and here you are, a big fancy radio presenter and journalist and all the rest of it, and you go home around your kitchen table. Maybe they don't think that's quite so impressive.
Mom, can I have something?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So then you become the run the service industry at your home, that you are the transport and food preparation industry that you run. When Shakespeare returns home, it doesn't matter that he's written 37 plays that add up to perhaps the greatest volume of dramatic literature in the Western culture. He's the guy who wasn't around much. Also, Ben, I think, there comically, but in this film, maybe with more serious undertow, has family conversations that aren't necessarily about the thing you're talking about, you know. So you might have that argument over something that spilled at the dinner table, but that suddenly goes nuclear, but it isn't about what you spilled. It's about the thing that happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago, when you didn't say the thing, or you did say the thing, and it has not been forgotten by a person for whom it was a sort of life-defining experience. And sometimes those family, you know, intense, dramatic moments really sort of are great breakthrough moments in understanding, but they're not very comfortable, but they are very compelling viewing if you're a sort of a spectator. And one of the things we wanted to do was put people here sort of in a ringside seat at the Shakespeare family.
You directed the film as well. And I'm this is, let me back into this question. You have to wear a lot of prosthetics
yes.
in this film.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to become William Shakespeare with the fake nose and the receding hair? And
we did a series of tests that would while we assembled that look, which was to try and recreate the vision of him that's in something called the Chandos portrait, which hangs in the National Portrait Gallery in London. It's the most familiar image of him and the one we think is most likely to have been sat for by William Shakespeare himself. So from the life, we wanted to create that. Eventually, when we'd practiced enough, we got it down to about an hour and a half in the morning. So I'd go and sit in that chair pretty early, close my eyes and open my eyes to see... well, really, even as I think of it now, it was always a shock to the system. But it meant that you were part of this sort of immersion. And then when you walked on set, when we did nighttime scenes, we used only candlelight. It was natural light in the daytime. We were very discreet with the cameras. So we were in a beautiful, authentic location of the time. So very regularly, you really felt you were in a time travel scenario. It was a magical thing to be part of, actually.
What does having those kind of prosthetics do for you as an actor?
Well, there's a ritual in just creating the sort of meditative time, reflective time to think about the man. And I wanted to get myself out of the way. All I wanted to have left were the eyes, because in that Chandos portrait where you stand in front of it, the eyes are so lively. They're the eyes of a man who might have come up with all those kind of teasing titles. They're playful, warm. They're sort of good company eyes, but they defy you to take him too seriously and they defy you to pin him down, rather like Shakespeare's work has done for centuries. We never know, is he religious? Is he political? If he is, what's the political persuasion? And he continues to be sort of elastic, and people with entirely conflicting ideas about what these plays are about can produce performances of them that are completely compelling, suggesting he's many, many different things. So his elusiveness was really something that's always attracted me, and the process of putting on all that makeup on was to try and land back at the Shakespeare that you were trying to present, which in this case was just the one with the most humanity.
So that's why you really... That's interesting. So the prosthetics, we're looking at this picture, this image that we all know, but you as an actor need to still have your eyes available to you.
Yeah, it was one thing I didn't want to do. So in that picture, his eyes are a sort of greeny hazel. But you do, I think, put a little barrier between yourself and the audience if you go with those contact lenses. So my own sort of grey blue eyes remain in place there in order to just... see the sort of, your hope anyway, the sort of universal soul that comes out of this guy who, like it or not, he looks the way he looks, and we sometimes are amused or we dismiss this sort of very familiar image of man with high collar and a quill, and it can seem, you know, sort of only comic. But when you see that when you see that ordinary person going through extraordinary things, for me it was about trying to humanize this guy, try and find our way to what it's like, even for him, to understand what it is to be, on the one hand, an acknowledged genius, and on the other hand, a, you know, flawed or imperfect father, husband, friend. These are quite big tensions.
This is a silly question, and I know it is, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You obviously couldn't come out of the prosthetics when you were directing. Was it ever a distraction for the other actors or for yourself?
Ian McKellen said it was an absolute nightmare. he said, we'd do this scene and then out of the dark, lit only by these candles from behind, William Shakespeare looms. And of course, Ian and Judi Dench had both performed Shakespeare so much.
Oh,
they had
yes.
their own ideas about what the man might have been. So it was, it was very unusual, and they both teased me about it mercilessly. But they enjoyed it, because with our candlelight and our setting, we very often, as it were, you close your eyes and you're there.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Kenneth Branagh. We're talking about the new film All Is True. It opens May 10th. It's about William Shakespeare in his later years as he comes to grips with his life and his legacy. You mentioned Ian McKellen, and he plays.
The Earl of Southampton.
Thank you. He plays the Earl of Southampton. And there's a magnificent scene where there's a suggestion that there's this great sexual attraction between William Shakespeare and the Earl of Southampton, and perhaps these sonnets that Shakespeare wrote were for him. Mm-hmm. Let's take a listen to Kenneth Branagh and Ian McKellen.
They were only meant for you, Your Grace, not for any other living soul, nor any yet to live. Just you.
was only flattery, of course. Flattery that was my due.
Yes. Just flattery. Except I spoke from deep within my heart.
Well, I was younger then. Younger and prettier.
Beautiful, Your Grace. As you will ever be when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes. I all alone beweep my outcast state and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope with what I most enjoy, contented least, yet in these thoughts myself almost despising. Haply I think on thee and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings that then I scorn to change my state with kings.
It's such a sensual scene as you're watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, there's always been discussion, was William Shakespeare gay? Was he bisexual? Mm-hmm. Did he have these relationships? Why was that important to explore?
Well, he produced this volume of sonnets and this narrative poem, Venus and Adonis, and both were extravagantly dedicated to the Earl of Southampton. And although that was the fashion of the time, because artists needed patrons, so they said nice things about them. However, the sort of depth of feeling and the very, very personal nature of the sonnets, both to a young man and also to a dark lady, have this very intimate quality that Shakespeare unlocks in that piece you've just played, where the idea of something else Shakespeare wrote about a lot, unrequited love, is also at play, because in Macallan's brilliant response to that, he throws the sonnet back at him, he repeats it, but finds a way to do it as only a master like he can, that suggests that maybe he does love him, but not in that way, so it becomes the greatest kind of letdown possible. But he also is quite explicit in saying, this cannot happen, you are a peasant, I'm an aristocrat. It will not work. So he's ruthless about that, and yet at the same time he flirts with him, and so it's multi-layered. It becomes very complex, and this relationship which Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife, finds out about only, as it were, through rumor. She does not read or write. She can't. She may be grateful for the fact that she can't read these poems, but that betrayal or perceived betrayal inside that complex married relationship adds, I think, a very complicated element to the sort of triangle in this movie. And it also presents just that moment that maybe people imagine or fantasize about or sometimes experience in their own lives, when a figure from the past arrives, and perhaps this will be the great hurrah that sends me off into some imagined, you know, perfect relationship instead of the troublesome one that perhaps is the more realistic one in anybody's life. But certainly I remember the morning we did a scene with Judi Dench where she talks about the visit of Southampton and really lets Shakespeare have it. She was on set on her own before I arrived, which is unusual. And she was stomping about, really seething on Anne's behalf. She really, so she really did let him have it. So there was something about the very human material inside this that brought out a very personal response from both Judi and from Ian.
She is the most perfect person for this role for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at someone who's formidable, who you think would take on William Shakespeare, that you can believe, Judi Dench is a human form that you believe that.
For sure. And also you believe that strength from a woman who cannot read or write, and yet you know to be a formidable creature regardless of those skills. This is someone he married when he was 18. She had something. They stayed married. She had something, and he had something for her. And as complex as it would have been, they stay together. And it's very touching, I think, that they work out whatever you might call it, an understanding across those 3 years that is about, you know, believing somehow in the power of the longevity of their relationship. That counts for something. and in the capacity to, in absorbing crisis and tragedy, the loss of their son, the resolution, the final talking about of it, that maybe some kind of progress can be made in their own relationship. None of it is easy, but all of it's quite inspiring to see, because it's just the normal sleeves rolled up, kind of put one foot in front of the other, human stuff that we all have to go through, even William Shakespeare.
My guest has been Sir Kenneth Branagh. His new film is All Is True. It will open in theaters this Friday, May 10th. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you, Angela. I really enjoyed it.
Coming up after the break, we're talking Game of Thrones with the ultimate water cooler companion, Bernie Caulfield, one of the show's executive producers. Stay with us. This is All of It on WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.